Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by outsourcing around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. So when you buy from American Giant, you're taking a stand for hardworking people, local communities, and quality clothes. American Giant directly supports American manufacturers and ensures you aren't footing that tariff bill. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
Hello, welcome along to another episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Thank you so much for your company and for your ears. Really appreciate you taking the time to join us. Very excited about this episode. Our latest guest on Soundtracking is the wonderful Kevin McDonald. Great to have him back on the podcast. And he joins me to discuss his extraordinary documentary, One-to-One, John and Yoko. Now, the film is set in the period between 1971 and 73, when they lived in a tiny apartment in Greenwich Village in New York. And it revolves around the footage of this benefit concert, One-to-One, that they did at Madison Square Gardens, which was remarkably the only significant live performance of John's after he left the Beatles. We also get plenty of never-before-seen or heard footage of their time in the village and a truly insightful series of telephone conversations. One-to-One was made with the blessing of the Lennon estate, with Sean Ono Lennon overseeing the remastering of the audio, which was only salvageable thanks to developments in technology. So we'll begin with one of the songs performed at the gig, Cold Turkey.
Good. I'm a bit busy. I'm prepping a film and trying to do some press on the John Lennon thing. So it's quite full on, shall we say?
This was so. I kind of went into watching this really trying to kind of not look into anything about the film at all. Oh my God, it was so refreshing on so many levels. I felt like I knew everything about John Lennon. I felt like I'd seen the different sides and stories of him being told in so many ways. But this was just felt like something completely revelatory in a way, and just so clever in how you've told the story and how you've kind of really lent into him as a person rather than John Lennon. Do you know what I mean? In terms of how someone like that can really throw their weight to things that they are connected to or want to try and make a change or at least start a conversation. It was so many things. So thank you and congratulations.
Oh, that's very nice to hear. That's very nice to hear. I mean, obviously the main thing about making a film like this is that you've got the anxiety of thinking, oh my God, there's been so many films about the Beatles and about John Lennon. How do you do something that is worth making that adds to the understanding or to the pleasure of people who, you know, are big fans of him and the music? And so before I went into it, that was really my worry. I was like, oh God, what a great opportunity, but I don't want to make just another film about him that is unnecessary.
Yeah. You know, what started that journey of going, I'm going to make a film about John or John and Yoko? Or what was that kind of the start of that journey? And also what got you over that, not that hurdle, but that thought of like, how do I do that?
It was a couple of different things. One was that I read an interview with John. I did a little bit of research and I read an interview with him where he talked about how much he loved TV and how he's obsessed with watching TV when he first got to America then. And how really, as we know, until he died, actually, he watched a lot of TV. And that resonated with me personally because I spent a lot of my younger childhood in America, going from Scotland, where I was at school, going to visit my grandparents in America. And the kind of riotous pleasure of switching on the American TV, having been brought up with obviously three channels, switching off at, you know, 12 o'clock at midnight and not on in the afternoon, all that sort of stuff in Britain. And then ending up in America where you'd wake up, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, jet lagged in the first few days you're there, and switch on the TV. And there was just channel after channel after channel. And that kind of almost sense of excess of that. And I thought, oh, I can relate to when he talks about TV and how that became his way of understanding this country and how he gloried in it. But also, once I'd had that thought, I thought, oh, well, what about doing this film using the TV that John watches, and we are in his head?
Yeah.
And we're seeing the times and the politics and the music whenever as he's seeing it on television. And I thought, oh, that's actually a really interesting idea. And then I also thought, maybe this is an opportunity where somebody will be happy to give me money to make a really out there kind of film structurally. And because I spoke to Sean Lennon, who I had to sort of pitch the idea to, and he said, that sounds like a crazy idea. That sounds like the kind of idea my mum would like, you know, doing it using, you know, these random clips from TV and stuff. And then, you know, the Mercury Studios, part of Universal, you know, obviously a commercial-based entity, but they were good enough to sort of be just really trusting and say, oh, you know, okay, do what you want. So, because I think they, like everyone else, knew we have to do something different. There's no point in doing another film about Lennon. But that was one thing. The other thing was just simply, the film is obviously, it's not a concert film, but it's sort of built around this concert, which is the only concert, amazingly, the only concert that John ever gave after he left the Beatles. And obviously the Beatles stopped touring in 66 and he did one full length concert, which was this concert in 72. Mm. And so I knew of this concert. I'd seen bits of it on YouTube. But the thing is, it would only ever been released on VHS in 1986. And the reason for that was because it was so badly recorded and badly filmed, to be honest, but badly, very badly recorded. So it was kind of not really a fair representation of him, and the family didn't like it for that reason. And, you know, nobody much liked it. But with the advent of amazing new sound technology, as you know, you can clean up almost anything. You can take the voice or the bass or the guitar or whatever and isolate it for anything else. So they were able to remix the concert. And suddenly when I heard, like, they were only halfway through remixing it, and I heard that, Instant Karma, I think was the song, and I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. And he is so good. And you think, I've never seen him like this. I've never seen him giving a fucking rock concert and actually giving it all and loving it and the crowd agrees. And you're like, oh my God, this is amazing. You think, I never saw that with the Beatles, except in them in the funny suits and all of that, because they stopped doing it. And obviously you've seen it with Paul McCartney, but it's a whole different thing seeing it with John. So I thought, wow, what an opportunity to basically, I mean, people have seen it before, but it's a totally different thing now that you can really hear what's going on. Instant Karma's gonna get you. Gonna knock you right in the head. You better get yourself together. Pretty soon you're gonna be dead. What in the world are you thinking of?
gonna get you. Gonna knock you right in the face. You better get yourself together, darling. Join the human race.
As well, I love that you have that performance from her in there, and you can, with the way that he's watching her perform as well, that's kind of just beautiful.
I know there's so much care and love in how he is around her, and particularly the pride of seeing her perform. And I think it's one of the things that, you know, even now, and I'm sure you've heard that, you know, even now big Beatles fans will say to you, oh, I hope you don't have any of Yoko screeching in the film. And like, that's her performance. She's an artist. She's doing something amazing that is pre-punk, which is like expressing the pain she's had about her child being kidnapped and not seeing her child for all these years. And so to me, that's an amazing performance. She's singing, I should explain, she's singing in the film. She sings this song called Don't Worry, Kyoko, which is about her daughter, Kyoko, who John had adopted. And they sort of lived with her for a while. And then her ex-husband kidnapped Kyoko. And the reason that John Yoko actually went to America in the first place in 1971 was because they were trying to find her. They knew Kyoko was in America, but they didn't know where.
Oh, yeah.
And they went there to sort of hire private investigators and do all sorts of stuff to try and track her down. They didn't manage to track her down. Then Yoko was only reunited with her in the 90s after it had long since gone by. Sort of subtext through the whole film, and because obviously the other thing about the other sort of impulse to make the film was, you know, who is Yoko? People have this antagonistic relationship with her, and for all these different reasons, you know, they blame her for breaking up the Beatles, they think she's not talented as a singer, all these things. But it's like, well, John's a very clever guy. He's fallen in love with somebody who he admires and he loves her so.
Inspired by, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is that about? What is her talent? What is the thing that he is so drawn to? And also, who is she as a human being? What's she feeling through all of this? And you realize you've never really seen any of that.
Yeah.
Maybe partly because she's chosen not to reveal it. I don't know. But then we were lucky enough to get hold of these phone calls.
They're amazing. They're so I found it so emotional, feeling like I was eavesdropping in on their, you know, these kind of conversations. It's such a great gift.
Yeah, they're absolutely amazing. Now, they only appeared halfway through the edit, actually, and I got a phone call from the stage, and they said, oh, we've just found this box. It says phone recordings, 1972. That's the period you're making the film about. Do you want to have a listen to them? And I'm like, yeah, please. And they send over 20 something hours of recordings. So they for a while they recorded every phone call that came in and out of their apartment. They're just on these reel to reel, you know, recorder, and they're totally fascinating because this is like, oh, this is them when they're not on a TV show, when they don't think they're being listened to or whatever. You know, they're actually, this is like the real them, and it's so, it is, as you say, like eavesdropping into their lives.
8071.
Is Howard there, please? Could you tell him John Lennon called?
Charlie, yes. O-N. Yeah.
Well, you remember the Beatles?
That's right, yeah.
Good morning, folks. Have you had your breakfast yet?
It's not like your nation is over. But we can start all over again, right?
I just got to see the village for the first time. I really feel at home there.
I was considered a bitch in this society. Since I met John, I was upgraded into a witch.
I fell in love with an independent, creative genius. I started waking up.
Why would you do a concert for free?
To change the apathy that all the youth have. Speak to them, sing to them, and do anything to get them alive again. Vive la revolution.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us.
How would you like to be remembered?
Just as two lovers.
So that was amazing. And in there, you really feel Yoko as a person.
Yeah.
And actually, this whole theme of her missing daughter, and became in a way the sort of emotional through line for me of the film. It becomes about damaged children and missing children. And
yeah.
Parenthood. And obviously that you realize sort of two-thirds of the way through the film that the reason this concert was put on, the one concert that John did after the Beatles, was to do with helping children. And that was, yeah, was actually a benefit concert for these children, disabled kids at a institution, kind of horrible, like Victorian miserable institution where the kids were being treated just, yeah, horrendously. And he saw a news report about this place called Willowbrook and thought, I want to do something to help. I want to raise money. And so this sort of idea of the pain of not being near your parents, or, you know, not having your kids around, or what childhood does to you, the damage it does to you, as John obviously talks about a lot, you know, that becomes kind of the emotional heft of the film, I think.
Yeah, well, even kind of, because it does pull on, you know, you hear him talking about his childhood, like you say, and so that kind of through line. And then even sort of when he's, you know, when he's, I think he's talking to a reporter, and it's the whole kind of potential deportation, you know, and his main kind of reason for fighting that so kind of vehemently is because of his adopted daughter and their daughter. It's, yeah, kind of like, we, yeah, can't, we're here to find her. We're here. That's why we're here, kind of thing. It's so powerful. It's such a powerful film, really is. And that moment as well, I love talking about Yoko when on one of the phone calls where I can't remember who she's talking to, but where she describes the Beatles, like when she's asked about the Beatles and she says something about, you know, there are four guys who kind of, they grew up together, but they kind of grew apart. But it's so eloquent the way that she puts it. It's not preconceived. It's not kind of something that she's planned. It's just her response, natural response to someone in a conversation. And you're like, oh my God, you're brilliant.
No, she's incredibly brilliant. And John is also very brilliant. Those phone calls, it's just like made me laugh. There's just like, yeah, so many great witticisms. And he's so sharp. He's so with it. So that's one of the pleasures of it. You know, there's a lot of politics in it, and there's a lot of music, but there's also the real, you know, the fun of it in a way is the humor of the humor of John. And I think, and because it's all not him performing for the cameras or whatever, it's, there's a sweetness to it. And there's a sweetness to him all through it. There's a sort of naivety, in fact, isn't there? There's a, like he's like this very open person who wants to help the world, wants to change the world, wants to figure out, who am I after the Beatles? I've been in this band, the Beatles, it's like dominated my life, but now it's all over. And who am I? What do I do with myself? And you can sort of almost see him trying to figure that side out. But to me, it's that the sense of what comes with that is this openness to the world and to experiences and to different people's opinions, and which you just very rarely see in anyone. Actually, you know, that, yeah, the idea that particularly someone successful who's usually like, oh, I'm fine, I know what I'm doing, I, you know, other, yeah, people should be as good as I am, but they're not. and he's just like really open-minded to the world, and that's super appealing.
there's some amazing characters, you know, outside of kind of John and Yoko in it as well. The guy who's going through Dylan's bins and stuff, it's just and Ginsburg, and kind of, it's just like you've really transported us to that. You feel immersed in it, you know, in terms of, and a lot of that's got to do with the music as well that we hear throughout the film. Yeah. And you know, I can't imagine how you kind of navigated that, you know, in terms of what you put in there, you know, in terms of outside of the concert.
Yeah.
So that must have been an interesting.
I mean, I think that the film has no music other than music that's made at the time. So that, where the conceit is that, you know, everything in the film comes from between September 71 and I think April 73, which is sort of, and it's about, the structure of it is around this concert, but also around the, when they move into this apartment, this tiny apartment, one room apartment, basically in Greenwich Village, and they decide they're going to live this very simple life, the two tatami life, as Yoko calls it. You know, it's kind of like you only need the room for your tatami mat and then a space next to it to stand up in. And that was her philosophy. But I built a set of that room. And my wife was good enough, who's a great set decorator, to sort of work on it, and drove her crazy trying to find
the hardest job in the world she's done. Yeah, I heard her say.
Yeah, really. That's what she said. She still reminds me of that a lot, because it's like finding, it's not just like normally you do set decorating a film and it's like, oh, you know, do an apartment for a poet in the 1920s in London or whatever. And it's like, okay, I can make something up. This is like, find that record that was in the photograph, find that map, those books, the exact amp, the exact guitar, the exact, you know, make the bed spread, all of that. So we did it. We did a really intricate sort of reconstruction of what that apartment was like, and that becomes the sort of the basic place where everything, sort of all these other strands of the film, come out from this apartment, which we move around. And they moved in, I think, into that apartment September 71, and as I say, that 18 months later or 15 months later, they moved out. So that's the sort of the period the film covers, and the archive, all the archive is from that period, and all the music is from that period, obviously. And so you are totally immersed in that period of American history, which weirdly, as we made the film, we realized this period of American history is almost a direct reflection of now.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, Richard Nixon, who's a, you know, a populist politician, another politician, George Wallace, who gets shot on the stump while saying things that are very Trumpian when he's talking about, you get the first black woman to run for president at that time. You get the college campuses up in arms about Vietnam, and it's very similar to what's going on with Gaza. So it felt like the more we got into that period, it felt like, oh, it's really a kind of reflection of today. And that was a surprise to me, actually. I didn't realize that was going to be such a interesting sort of foreshadowing of the present day.
Yeah, scary how things haven't changed, isn't it? Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Exactly. And with having that kind of, you know, having Sean working with the family, I imagine, and the estate on that, you know, and kind of getting that, building that trust with them and you know, having them involved in it, that must be a massive kind of help as well. Was Sean involved in the music at all?
Sean was in charge of overseeing the music remix, because obviously he is a musician.
Yeah.
And so he did that basically with other people, obviously, but he was overseeing that. It took a long time. It took a long, long, long time to get that right. But weirdly, once Sean had pitched him over Zoom what I wanted to do, he's like, that's cool. He said to their kind of, you know, the guy who runs the archive for them, he said, just give them whatever they want from that period. And so it was literally, here's a drive with all the home movies. Here's a drive with this. So it was like this treasure trove of stuff that people have never seen before. And of course, what you began to realize is that it's so lucky that we're making it about the film about this period, because this is the only period of his life where there's a load of home movies, all these phone recordings, that they were out and about in the streets of New York being filmed at protests and going to art openings and all that. So there was a lot of stuff that was, total joy to be able to go through all that. But I should also say that, you know, one of the advantages about doing a film like this, which is all the voices of the people in question, of Yoko and John, and doesn't sort of have other people's opinions coming in or whatever, is that I didn't get any sort of sense of that of the family going, oh, I don't, you know, disapprove of this, I don't agree with that, because it's all coming from them. So there was no kind of commentary of kind of like, oh, you know, that's not true, or this person's where. So we actually had no interference at all. It was a great, a very simple experience.
I went to see Paul McCartney just before Christmas at the O2.
Ah.
Oh, it was amazing. It was so, again, it was just so emotional because you kind of, you watch him elevated on this platform with his guitar singing Blackbird, and you're just like,
Amazing.
am I ever going to see this again? Do you know what I mean? It's
No,
kind of like, what a
incredible.
lucky thing to see. But it was so, there were two moments that were so kind of just kind of ingrained in my brain. And one of those was Now and Then when he played that, and kind of hearing John's voice resonate around the room. And then there was another moment as well where I guess they used a similar kind of technology where he was actually able to sing with John on a track, one of the last tracks that they played on the roof of the Apple
Wow.
building and stuff. And there was not a dry eye in the house. Like everybody, it was like you could hear a pin drop in the O2. It was just,
Wow, how
it was,
amazing.
oh, it was very, 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 very special. It was great. So good. Yeah, it was
I think the
amazing.
other thing about this period of John's music, though, is that this is the kind of unloved period, I guess. It's the sort of political period when he did lots of political songs, and I think that when you see the concert, the footage in this, you realize that musically it's really strong, actually, and it's got this sort of slightly pub rocky kind of flavor to some of it, but his musicianship and his kind of authority on stage pulls everyone else together, makes everyone else better than they would otherwise be. That's the feeling like that. So more than anything else, actually, I come away from watching that footage feeling like, why the hell did he not do more live? You know, he was so bloody good at it, and he plays the audience so well, and he's so cheeky in his sort of replacing of words in the songs, and he's just, you know, he's really, really a great live performer. And yet you think, well, how many times have you seen him live? Hardly, you know, hardly anything exists of him playing live.
Especially outside the Beatles.
Yeah, 100%, 100%.
The song that he wrote to as a kind of protest for the guy who was imprisoned for having a
John
joint,
Sinclair,
John Sinclair. That was like the telephone conversation about with his manager, was it about kind of like what are the three songs you're going to play? And his manager was kind of like, oh, I'm not sure. It's just
It's
such a
classic.
lovely.
It's such a classic musician to their manager relationship call, isn't it? Where the manager goes, I think it's not a good idea. Don't do that. It's going to be too. No, don't do that. And then basically when John says, no, I'm doing it, and he's like, yeah, I think it's a really good idea. I think it's, yeah, it's a really great, it's a great idea, John. Fantastic idea, wonderful idea. And it's just like, this is the power dynamic that is still the same today in every film star and every musician. But yeah, no, it's really funny that. And that's really the sort of the moment. 'Cause, well, what happened was there's this guy, John Sinclair, is put in prison in Michigan for being caught with two joints, two pre-rolled joints, and he gets 5 years in prison. And there's a big, you know, and he's a big peace activist, and whatever. And so it becomes this big national story about this injustice. And John gets involved and says, I'm going to come to this benefit concert. I'm going to sing a song. I'm going to write a song. And so he writes this song, which is pretty basic protest kind of stuff. But yeah, it's fun.
It ain't fair.
Up, and it's hilarious. I love the footage there, because you've got like this stone naked student walking around in the front of the shot, and like, where the hell am I? Oh my God, John Lennon's there. And he sings this song. Then 2 days later, this guy John Sinclair is released from prison because of the pressure that the governor of Michigan receives over John being there and all the news about it. So they release him from prison. There's amazing footage of him getting out and phoning John and gratitude. And this, of course, makes John and Yoko go, oh, we could actually change things. If this is the power we've got, we could really use this And so that's kind of precipitates their whole involvement in politics and their anti-Nixon kind of activism and all of that.
She just turned 92 as well. She? Yeah. Has she seen the film? She must feel wonderful if she has, because it's such a...
I actually don't know. We did send her the film, but we haven't heard anything. I understand that she's old and not terribly well. So, but I would hope that she's seen it. But no, I don't. Yeah. I haven't heard, which is a shame.
Yeah. Just before we finish as well, I was up in Glasgow on Sunday for the Glasgow Film Festival, and I was hosting a kind of career chat with Mr. James McAvoy. And straight after our chat, they were showing The Last King of Scotland.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, that's 20 years ago. Because funnily enough, I was at the BAFTAs this year, and they did a sort of, they got James McAvoy on to sort of, I think, give the audience award, the Orange, or what used to be called the Orange Film Award, whatever it's now, the EE Film Award, whatever, which is the you know, the one BAFTA voted on by the public.
The Rising Star,
The Rising Star, that's what it's called, sorry, yeah. So he was the first winner of that in the year of Last King of Scotland. And they showed this footage of him, it's hilarious, with a terrible haircut. Really funny haircut.
Floppy Joe.
Yeah. He's definitely got a better barber now. And that's lovely. That's lovely. Yeah,
it was great. Well, listen, huge congratulations on this film. It really is. I've been like wanging on about it to so many people as well. I was like, oh my God, you have to see this. Just because it's so refreshing as well in terms of, you know, in the world of music and telling someone in that world's story in such a kind of beautiful and kind of creative way. And just, those phone calls in themselves are just like, wow, sucker punch. They're brilliant.
That's lovely. Yeah. That's lovely to hear. What I've noticed is that talking about it, it's quite a hard film to talk about because it's such an experiential sort of thing. Mm. And there's so many things going on in it. And we sort of talk a bit about phone calls, a bit about the concert, and a bit about the politics and the TV and the park.
So much in there.
There's a lot in there, but it's actually only 96 minutes. I think it's the shortest film I've ever made.
Wow.
That's a good thing.
Wow.
Well, I kind of thought it's not your normal film. I thought I'm not going to bore people with this. I'm going to make it short and sharp, and which is an uncharacteristic discipline.
I just that idea of like kind of people being bored like with your films is kind of like, come on. I'm really looking forward to kind of going with a gang of mates though to see it at the cinema as well, because I think it's kind of going to be one of those things as well that you just kind of come out feeling a bit sort of kind of almost empowered in a way as well.
Well, that's what we need, is a little bit of political hope, don't we? And there's a voice that feels like he really sort of, you know, is daring to disagree with the establishment, and that's what you get from John. But the other thing I should say is that the film's coming out on IMAX, which I'm really excited about. On the what was 9th, 10th or something of April, it's coming out on IMAX for a week exclusively, and then it will go on to wider cinema. So if any of your listeners really want to hear at its best, as I did the other day in IMAX, it just sounds fantastic. And I now only want to make films for IMAX.
Great. Okay. Well, I'll let you get back to that then. Great to chat to you as always. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Lovely to chat to you. Speak soon.
In One to One, John and Yoko, that's Well, 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 rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Kevin McDonald. A huge thanks to Kevin for taking the time to talk to us. While you've missed the opportunity to see it at IMAX for now, One to One is on general release and really does shed new light on the character of the iconic musician and his relationship with Yoko and also Yoko herself. So if you get the chance, please do go and see it in cinemas. Head to edithbowman.com to hear my previous conversations with Kevin and to find every single other episode of the podcast. At Soundtrackin' UK is a place to find us on your socials, and we also have a YouTube channel, Soundtrackin' Extra, so please do subscribe to that too. Next up is only our very dear friends, Ryan Coogler and Ludvig Göransson, who are in the house to discuss their latest collaboration, Sinners, which is out in cinemas this coming Friday. So maybe you can go and see the film and then check in on Monday for a brand new episode with the pair. I cannot wait to share this conversation with you. Sinners is, I mean, we know that Ryan's a great filmmaker. We know that him and Ludvig have a great creative partnership, but man, did they go and explore this even further with this film. Anyway, Ryan Coogler, Ludvig Göransson, join me next week. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.